That's why we say Alaska is a really important strategic location. Because of the technology that we have with air refueling, we can be in a lot of places pretty quick.
The new F-35 fighter jet gets a flight test in Fairbanks. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, October 18th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, leaders from King Cove say their new push for a road isn't a backroom deal.
It's not like we've said, oh, by the way, let's meet in a dark alley someplace late at night.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by
Raven Alaska, committed to customer safety and satisfaction, reminding Alaska that now is a great time to fly. Learn more at flyravn.com.
The state's top law enforcement officials are rolling out a new initiative aimed at curbing violent crime in Alaska. At its heart is more collaboration between federal, state, and local officials. But the majority of policy measures are aimed at crime in Anchorage, without many new measures for rural Alaska or areas outside of the state's largest city. At a press conference today in the downtown Anchorage Federal Building, acting U.S. Attorney Brian Schroeder stood side to side with the heads of several state and federal law agencies. Alaska Public Media's Zachariah Hughes was there and joins us now to talk about what to expect in this new initiative. So, first of all, what new measures were announced today?
So, today we heard the announcement of the Alaska Anti-Violent Crime Strategy. There are a few different steps within that, but basically it's an effort between a lot of different federal agencies that have a presence in the state, like DEA, the ATF, Homeland Security, and it's getting them into closer coordination with state and local partners in regards to combating violent crime. As far as specifics go, we heard about a couple of initiatives. For every murder and shooting that happens in the municipality of Anchorage, for example, there'll be what's called a federal duty officer sent out to the scene. And the idea is that they can help build intelligence or offer some general assistance to the local law enforcement agency, in this case, the Anchorage Police Department. Likewise, there's a ballistics task force that's going to be reviewing evidence from shootings to look for patterns and potentially aid with prosecutions down the line. There are also going to be programs aimed at identifying violent offenders for federal prosecution, a new partnership between the state troopers and a federal prosecutor, along with some expanded reentry and anti-recidivism efforts.
And what about the timing of this? It seems like there's been a lot of news lately about reorganization within the Anchorage Police Department and talks of re-legislating Senate Bill 91. Where does this initiative fit with other efforts happening around the state?
Well, Acting District Attorney Schroeder says this strategy has been in the works for months, but it does dovetail with a more recent announcement by Attorney General Jeff Sessions and the Justice Department, where they want U.S. attorneys' offices all around the country to come up with plans for combating a nationwide uptick in crime. Part of that is the revival in something called Project Safe Neighborhoods, which was first introduced 15 years ago and has kind of ebbed in the years since, but it's a little bit of a playbook for collaboration between law enforcement agencies. Likewise, the state's attorney general, Jana Lindemuth, was there at the press conference, also making a statement and taking questions. And it's really state law enforcement and prosecutors that have seen a big drop in resources as a result of diminished budget appropriations by lawmakers in the last 2 or 3 years. So the troopers, the state's Department of Law, they're the ones really, really struggling to keep up with delivering justice, just as most state, federal, and local officials will tell you there's more crime happening. And this is one of those multi-pronged strategies that seems like it's trying to close gaps and get more efficient with handling violent crime and investigations.
Zach, the new initiatives that were announced today, are they focused primarily on Anchorage, other cities, or spread statewide?
This new strategy is very Anchorage-centric. At this point in time, there's no new dollars coming into the state overall from federal agencies or the Justice Department, so everything here is about leveraging existing capacity, and that capacity is overwhelmingly in Anchorage.
All right, Zach, last, were any of the officials that were there today offering any clear explanations for what's driving the uptick in violent crime.
No overarching general theory, no. Schroeder referred to crime related to opioids, less violent crime committed by, you know, street level users, but more so towards traffickers and people higher up the chain when it comes to importing and distributing opioids and heroin. Anchorage Police Chief Justin Dahl was also at the press conference today. In the past, he's called this very line of inquiry the department's million-dollar question. Members of the Anchorage Assembly recently have taken public testimony on this issue and heard people ascribe the uptick to drugs, to the state's recession, and even to just a general erosion in moral principles. So lots of explanations, but most people will tell you that it's multifaceted. There's not any one particular cause driving it. And this is happening outside of Alaska as well. Most of the reliable longitudinal indicators show a modest upward trend in serious crime. So it's not just Alaska that's looking for an answer on this question.
Zachariah Hughes covers Anchorage for Alaska Public Media. The city of King Cove is working closely with the Trump administration to find a way to build a road to Cold Bay through the Eisenbeck National Wildlife Refuge. But city leaders are taking issue with a recent Washington Post article that describes the administration attempting to conceal a behind-the-scenes deal to build the road. Environmental groups argue the road would harm wildlife in the Eisenbeck, and any plan should require public input and congressional approval. From Alaska's Energy Desk, Zoe Sobel has more.
Gary Hennig has been working for the city of King Cove for decades, and he's focused on making the road to Cold Bay a reality. He says the community needs the road to provide access to Cold Bay's all-weather airport so people aren't left stranded in medical emergencies. Hennig acknowledges that the Department of the Interior is working on an agreement that would allow the road with the King Cove Corporation. But he says it isn't a backroom deal.
It's not like we've said, oh, by the way, let's meet in a dark alley someplace late at night.
When Donald Trump was elected president last November, Hennig says community leaders immediately started discussing reaching out to the new administration. The conversation with the Interior Department got underway at the beginning of this year. Like other proposals, this deal would involve swapping land, this time between the King Cove Corporation and the federal government. The corporation would then own a land corridor where the road through the refuge could be built. Other deals have included some element of congressional approval. In 2013, after Congress directed then-Interior Secretary Sally Jewell to look into the road, Jewell rejected the idea, saying it would irreversibly damage the Eisenbeck Refuge and the wildlife that depends on it. This time around, Hennig thinks the deal could avoid Congress entirely.
We've come to be realistic to know that that legislative world is a pretty big challenge, and if we don't have to go there, we don't want to, and we want to see if this administrative agreement will work for us.
That administrative agreement Hennig mentions would be between the Interior Department and the King Cove Corporation. As he understands it, Congress approved administrative power in the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act and the Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act that could allow for land exchanges between the federal government and eligible Alaska Native corporations. So there would be no need for additional congressional approval. Hennig is hopeful this approach will work. But environmentalists like Nicole Whittington Evans of the Wilderness Society are angry. After so many public processes that all concluded the King Cove Road would significantly impact wildlife in the Eisenbeck Refuge, Whittington Evans is frustrated it's up for discussion again.
The federal government has exhaustively studied this and numerous times and always concluded with the fact that the road would have significant impacts to the refuge and its wildlife, which the refuge was established to protect.
Whittington Evans believes because Congress decided the Eisenbeck Refuge should be a designated wilderness area, the highest level of conservation given to any federal lands, it's only right that Congress would have to review any proposal to build a road.
For an administration to come along now and ignore congressional action and disregard all of the public input on this issue up to now shows a blatant disregard for existing laws and our nation's framework around public input.
She's worried the potential deal could undercut bedrock environmental laws like the Wilderness Act, the National Environmental Policy Act, and ANILCA. The Interior Department did not respond to a request for comment. Alaska's congressional delegation has strongly supported and advocated for a road to Cold Bay over the years. But if a deal is imminent, Senator Lisa Murkowski isn't dropping any hints. Here's Alaska Public Media's Liz Ruskin talking to the senator.
Are you hearing anything about it that's going to break on it this week?
I've been hoping that it was going to break months ago. So.
Hennig also isn't giving any indication of when a deal may become public, but he says the community is optimistic that a deal under this administration represents their best shot at the road in a very long time. For Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Zoe Sobel in Unalaska.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a celebration in Sitka for Alaska Day.
You know, we try and honor the regimental tradition of where the history of the bagpipers and pipes and drums came from.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Wells Fargo, offering financial tools to start, run, and grow a business. Learn more at wellsfargoworks.com. Education scholarships and grants for ANSEP, the Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program, are available. To learn where the possibilities this education can take you, visit beanengineeralaska.com. This community message on Alaska Public Media comes from ExxonMobil. Energy lives here.
That's Kevin Paul of the Swinomish Indian Senate singing at the close of the Elders and Youth Conference in Anchorage today. The three-day event aims at strengthening cultural knowledge and Indigenous identity and takes place each year just ahead of the Alaska Federation of Natives Convention. Through simple voice votes, delegates passed all seven of the resolutions brought to the floor. Proposals included broad-ranging calls for equity in rural education, protecting subsistence fishing rights, and a commitment to inclusivity for LGBTQ Alaskans, as well as more narrow, specific policy changes, such as adding an inflation adjustment to the $2,000 dividend tax exemption first put into place under the 1971 Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. From the stage, First Alaskans Institute President Liz Medicine Crow called for the vote.
All those in favor of this resolution signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, same sign. And again, it passes with unanimous consent.
The conference also passed a resolution that calls for a change in regulations over hunting sea otters. The animals are protected under the Marine Mammal Protection Act. That law requires hunters meet a federally designated blood quantum and be at least a quarter Alaska Native. Supporters of the resolution say that disqualifies a growing number of potential hunters and providers and ask that the eligibility be determined by tribal membership among direct descendants. The seven resolutions will go for a vote before delegates at the full AFN convention held in the downtown Anchorage Denaina Convention Center that starts Thursday and runs through Saturday. The Iditarod Trail Committee Board of Directors has named Joseph Joey Reddington Jr. the 2018 Honorary Musher. Reddington passed away in August and was the oldest son of Joseph Reddington Sr., often called the father of the Iditarod. The Honorary Musher traditionally begins the race as the first across the ceremonial start line in Anchorage. In 2018, the position will be reserved for Reddington Jr.'s wife, Pam. According to a press release, she says she's honored by the selection and that her husband would have been honored too. Reddington Jr. completed competed several times in the Iditarod in the 60s and 70s. His top finish was in 1975 when he took third place. He and his wife were better known, however, as champion sprint mushers. The Reddingtons lived in Manly Hot Springs west of Fairbanks. Reddington Jr. worked to help the community transform into the third Iditarod Trail checkpoint in 2003, 2015, and 2017. In those years, the race restart was moved to Fairbanks because of poor weather conditions. Pam Reddington will begin the ceremonial start of the 2018 Iditarod on March 3rd. For the first time in the history of the Iditarod, several of the high-performance animals have tested positive for a prohibited drug, but race officials have refused to name the musher involved. The governing body of the nearly 1,000-mile race said in a statement that several dogs tested positive for the opioid pain reliever Tramadol. Officials said the team was tested 6 hours after finishing the nearly 1,000-mile race in Nome in March. Officials say they likely could not prove legally the intent on the affected musher's part. Officials did not immediately respond to requests for comment and to say whether the musher faces discipline. Iditarod board member and musher Aaron Burmeister says he doesn't know the musher's identity, but he adds that only the first 20 teams to reach Nome are tested. The Alaska Department of Fish and Game is securing water rights along Alaska's major rivers. The Alaska Department of Natural Resources is currently taking public input on water reservation rights applications covering two stretches of the Tanana River near Fairbanks.
A water right is when you are removing water from a river for one purpose or another. In this case, this is a reservation of water where you're retaining water.
Kimberly Sager is the sole person handling water rights applications for the DNR. She says Fish and Game has primarily focused on water rights reservations on the Kuskokwim, Yukon, and now Tanana rivers to protect habitat for salmon and other fish.
So this is just one tool in their box that they can use to help manage the fisheries.
According to the DNR website, water is a common property resource in Alaska, and landowners do not have automatic rights to it. Sager says all known water uses are taken into account during the water reservation application process.
If something does come up, like a mine or a project or hydropower dam or something of that nature, we can always take a look, and we will account for them if we are aware of it going on at the time of adjudication.
It's not always Fish and Game seeking water rights, Sager says. In recent years, developers and critics of the proposed Chewitna coal mine project near Cook Inlet both applied for water reservation rights along the Middle River. Sager says the state has increased its rate of application from 4 or 5 a year to between 20 and 30 annually in light of what's happened in other states.
In the lower 48, as many people know, that the water has been fully appropriated and allocated for different uses, and they're actually buying back water now in order to save water for fisheries purposes. In this state, we're trying to be proactive.
Sager says more than 130 water right reservations have been issued so far, noting the rights are reviewed every 10 years after issue, allowing reconsideration in light of new issues or project proposals. Public comment is being accepted on the water reservation right applications for the Tanana River near Fairbanks through October 23rd. Eielson Air Force Base opened its doors yesterday to local, state, and federal officials to give them a chance to see an F-35 fighter up close and to learn about its capabilities. The Air Force sent the warplane here for a few weeks before testing in advance of the arrival of two squadrons beginning in 2020. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
The road to Eielson was coated with ice Tuesday, but the Air Force officer in charge of testing the F-35's ability to operate on icy runways says he can't use the natural stuff that comes from precipitation.
So we have to clear the ice, and then we have to put some ice down so it's consistent and we control the test.
Lieutenant Colonel Tucker Hamilton commands the 461st Flight Test Squadron out of Edwards Air Force Base in California, and he says the controlled testing the F-35A Lightning II is undergoing at Eielson requires consistent ice thickness in order to get valid test data.
So today it's literally just starting with like steering. At 5 knots, how does it turn? You know, is it skipping at all? And then we're going to hit the ice and slam on the brakes at different ground speeds.
Hamilton says the Air Force has been testing F-35s for years, and he says the icy runway tests are among the last that the state-of-the-art warplane will undergo before two squadrons begin to arrive at Eielson in 2020. He says most of the cold weather testing at temperatures as low as 50 below took place in a climate-controlled facility at Eglin Air Force Base in subtropical Florida.
Does the engine start? You know, how is the maintenance on the jet? Are people's hands too cold? Are there things freezing with the helmet? You know, we did all that testing in the lab itself.
Lieutenant General Ken Wilsbach, who heads up the Air Force's Alaskan Command, says all that testing has proven the F-35 is well suited for operations out of Eielson. He says the location is ideal because it's next door to vast expanses of airspace above the 65,000-square-mile Joint Pacific Alaska Range complex. And he says in a real-world situation, the 54 F-35s that'll be stationed at Eielson will be able to take advantage of Alaska's key global position to get to most any potential trouble spot between here the equator within 12 hours.
And so that's why we say Alaska is a really important strategic location. Because of the technology that we have with air refueling, we can be in a lot of places pretty quick.
The general says that's why Tuesday's event held inside a cavernous hangar on base included a KC-135 air tanker like those used by the Air National Guard's 168th Air Refueling Wing that's based at Eielson. And parked next to the F-35 was another stealthy advanced fighter, an F-22 Raptor out of Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson. Wilsbach says the F-22's air-to-air combat capabilities, combined with the F-35's advanced sensors and air-to-ground armaments, will deliver a potent punch against adversaries.
And so when you put them together, which is typically how we would plan to go into a fight, it's a pretty awesome capability. And there's no threat currently in the world that would be able to probably handle these two because of their synergies when they're put together.
Congressman Don Young says that capability shows the value of bringing the F-35s to Eielson.
This aircraft will put us within 9 hours of Korea if there's a conflict to occur. 12 hours between this and the Middle East. It is the most advanced aircraft, but we have the right location for it to be stationed.
Young called Tuesday's event a celebration of the buildup at Eielson, which includes 18 construction projects worth more than $500 million that are being built around the base to support the F-35s. At Eielson Air Force Base, I'm Tim Ellis.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein. Attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com.
Colder temperatures are here, and the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation reminds you of the danger of carbon monoxide, a poisonous gas that you can't see or smell. If it builds up in your home, it can be deadly. Be safe this winter and have a qualified mechanic ensure your heating system is working properly. Never run your car in the garage or operate a portable generator in an enclosed space. Finally, always ensure your home has a working carbon monoxide detector. This message sponsored by AHFC.
A Bristol Bay seafood processor has been fined by the EPA for violating the Clean Air Act. KDLG's Dave Benninger has more.
There were no incidents that triggered the penalties, but rather an alleged failure to report storage of anhydrous ammonia, which is commonly used for refrigeration at food processing plants. Bill Dunbar is a spokesperson at the EPA's Seattle office.
Any facility in the United States that has above a threshold amount of anhydrous ammonia on site needs to have a plan in place that protects its workers were there an accidental release and that protects nearby citizens and emergency responders.
The EPA determined that the Red Salmon Cannery in Naknek, owned by Seattle-based North Pacific Seafoods, had not reported it had at least 10,000 pounds of the anhydrous ammonia on site.
North Pacific came to our attention because they were missing from a database that tracks facilities that we know are large enough to store that threshold amount.
Dunbar says North Pacific agreed to some penalties to settle the Clean Air Act case with the EPA.
So the company will pay $45,743 in a penalty, and they'll spend about $175,000 on additional environmental projects that will help their energy efficiency at the facility.
Those will include installing a solar power system and upgrading lighting to LEDs at the cannery in Naknek. In Dillingham, I'm Dave Benninger.
It's Alaska Day today, and with it came a flurry of visitors to Sitka, some carrying musical instruments. The Seattle Firefighters' pipes and drums landed in Sitka on Saturday, and their first stop was the historic Cable House, home to Raven Radio. KCAW's Emily Kwong spoke with the drum major.
When Alaska Day rolls around in Sitka, you'll hear the Seattle Firefighters before you see them. At both formal events and the late-night bar scene, the skirl of bagpipes and rumble of drums quickly announces their arrival. The Seattle Firefighters' Pipes and Drums has been flying to Sitka to commemorate Alaska Day for over a decade. Their trip is covered by locals, and they lend a lot of ceremony to the occasion, which drum major Tyson DePoe says is exactly what the pipe band is for. The ensemble has roots in Celtic military history.
You know, we try and honor the regimental tradition of where the history of the bagpipers and pipes and drums came from.
While in Sitka, the group has also regaled residents of the Pioneer Home and Long-Term Care Facility, the Coast Guard Base, and Mount Edgecombe High School. Nearly half the band flew into town. DePoe says they're all active duty or retired firefighters and get together once a week to practice. Membership is voluntary.
It really calls those firefighters within the department that are looking for something extra, something above and beyond the normal scope of what we do to give back to not only the department but the community.
The group was established in 2004 to honor fallen firefighters. DePoe says the key to a good performance is knowing the audience and, in his case as drum major, setting things off on the right foot. He's the loud voice you hear at the beginning of the song, calling the band to attention and setting the tempo.
Green Hills, battle's over. And then I'll say, by the right, quick march. And so you can hear the tempo there, and they know that's the beat beat, or the boom boom of the bass drum, and then left, right, and they march in and play at the same time.
It's almost as though you're both conductor and metronome at the same
time. Yes, exactly. Yeah, and I'm not so good at walking and talking and chewing gum at the same time. So it's fairly challenging, but this is a great group of firefighters here.
DePoe then turns to the group and leads them in the Amazing Grace March. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Emily Kwong.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. You can find tonight's stories on our website, alaskapublic.org. We had reports tonight from Zachariah Hughes in Anchorage, Zoe Sobel in Unalaska, Gabe Colombo in Nome, Dan Bross and Tim Ellis in Fairbanks, Emily Kwong in Sitka, and Dave Benninger in Dillingham. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, Wesley Early is our web editor, and I'm Laurie Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com.
Colder temperatures are here, and the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation reminds you of the danger of carbon monoxide, a poisonous gas that you can't see or smell. If it builds up in your home, it can be deadly. Be safe this winter and have a qualified mechanic ensure your heating system is working properly. Never run your car in the garage or operate a portable generator in an enclosed space. Finally, always ensure your home has a working carbon monoxide detector. This message sponsored by AHFC.
This is statewide news on Alaska Public Media.